Welcome, everyone, to Asian Pacific Voices Radio, where you will find stimulating conversations about subjects and topics that are of interest to our Asian Pacific American communities. Hi, I'm Sasha Fu, your host. Today, our guest is Dr. Fa Lei, an emergency room doctor in Southern California, who spends many of his days, of course, treating patients in the ER, but he spends a lot of his time outside the hospital helping veterans and the unhoused. He is well regarded for both his work in medicine and for his philanthropy. Born in Vietnam in 1973, Dr. Lei fled Vietnam with his family when he was 9 years old, joining the many other refugees from Vietnam in search of economic opportunities and a more peaceful life. The Lei family wound up here in the United States, facing the challenges of both poverty and displacement. But despite those hardships, Dr. Lei excelled at his studies, obtained a medical degree, and now practices emergency medicine in Southern California. But it's what he does outside the ER that also makes his life a remarkable one. Welcome, Dr. Lei. Thanks for coming on with us at Asian Pacific Voices Radio.
Thank you, Sasha. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
I want to start by taking you back to those early days in Vietnam. Did you ever imagine where you were growing up in Vietnam that your life would take this path?
It was a world away. Growing up in the villages, we had truly meager upbringing. Food was scarce. We barely had enough to eat. The country was still recovering from war. Also of significance was that my father wasn't around. So I really didn't know the direction of my life. Growing up at that point, I just knew that, you know, I had to study and do what my mom asked me to do. But in no way could I imagine that this would be the place that I would end up.
Now, you alluded to the fact that your father was gone while you were growing up. Tell us about the circumstances surrounding that, and how did that factor into your family's choices to leave Vietnam?
Yeah, so as a child of the Vietnam War, my father was a combatant during the war. In the 60s, he was actually a really good student, and he got accepted to law school. But when the war got really heated, he decided to enter the Naval Academy of South Vietnam. He was chosen after scoring well on their entrance exam. So he completed his training at the Naval Academy at the Republic of South Vietnam in 1966, and he was in combat in the Mekong Delta for the majority of his service time. Well, when the war ended, he ended up in Guam, being evacuated with the rest of the Vietnamese refugees. But what happened after that is that he tried to reunite with my mother and I by returning back from Guam. I was only 2 years old at the time. And when he returned back to Vietnam, he couldn't reunite with me. He was actually taken straight to North Vietnam, where he was locked in one of the labor camps, the so-called re-education camp, where they overwork the prisoners and they underfeed them just to break down their bodies and their spirit. And so my father was in such a prison from 1975 until when he was released in 1980. You know, when we start forming our memories, you know, somewhere between 4 and 5 years old, I remember not having my father around. I started kindergarten without my father, and my first years of schooling was without my father.
When your father eventually was reunited after 1980, how did your family decide you wanted to leave Vietnam? Was that a difficult decision?
Yeah, it was actually really complicated. My father, when he was released in 1980, I actually remember meeting him for the first time, which is weird. Most children just remember, you know, growing up with their fathers. But I actually remember meeting my father. It took him 3 days to reach our village from his prison in the north. And after we met and I learned about our entire family history, about his family and his history. My parents actually conceived my baby brother. So now we were a family of three. He was trying to regain some sense of normalcy and try to get a regular job so that he could make a living for our family. But he would be interrogated every so often by the local authorities. They were concerned that he was still some type of spy, or that he was going to try to escape. So they would call him up randomly and interrogate him. Well, what these interrogations did was they gave him nightmares. And these nightmares became so intrusive that he realized there was just no way that he was going to be able to live in Vietnam in a normal life. So that's when he decided to plot an escape from Vietnam. But we, you know, we're a family of three. We have no money. Escaping at that time was still very treacherous. Those who escaped could have drowned in the ocean because of storms. Their boats would break down, and if you go by land, it's even more treacherous because you would have to go through the jungles to get through Cambodia to Thailand. So finally, my father decided that we were going to go by boat because he could be the captain of one of the escape boats, and mm-hmm. they would give us spots for the rest of our family. Well, when the right operation came around, as luck would have it, my baby brother was only 1 year old. My middle brother was five, and I was my middle brother was seven, and I was nine. And the boat owner would not allow for my father to bring our entire family. So they would have to make the excruciating decision of which family member to bring. My father and mother actually decided that they would bring me instead of my two younger brothers. And so they were left behind with my grandmother and my aunts to care for them. So that was an excruciating decision, because we would then have to live with the ramifications of leaving them behind for years to come, because we did not reunite with those two children for another 10 years. So it was just very complicated, very heart-wrenching. I now understand how difficult this decision was for my parents to escape, but my father just could not live in Vietnam one more day because of what they were doing to his mind.
Well, happily, the family was eventually reunited, but there's a couple of stops in between. You went to a refugee camp, I believe it was in Indonesia. Is that what you
said? Yeah. So, yeah, we escaped. My father was very skilled in his navigations, and he got us to the refugee camp in just 3 days. But we stayed in the refugee camp for a year before settling in the U.S. in 1983.
Okay. So the early days in the United States were tough ones. It often is for refugees. They have the challenges of learning a new language, and also the challenge of finding employment that's going to support a family. Your family was in similar situations where you asked for help from the community, but your parents are also very resourceful. Can you tell me about that and how you actually managed to go to college, get a medical degree, coming from such humble beginnings?
Yeah, I would echo that thought that, you know, refugees have a very rough start at the beginning. And it's only through their resilience and being able to lean on their communities, whether it's friends or other families that have come before them, and, you know, governmental help, that they can get on their feet and get to the next level. When we landed in Roanoke, Virginia, we lived in the projects there, the housing projects, for a few months. My parents realized that as educated professionals from Vietnam, that in order for them to make a good new life here in America, they needed their education to continue. So we use We harnessed our resources and moved around the country in order to find the right place for that. So from Roanoke, Virginia, we boarded a Greyhound bus for 3 nights and went across the country without one hotel stay, just bus to bus for 3 nights. And we landed in Kent, Washington. And that was at first a good, it sounded good that we were going to be able to get an education for my parents, but it turned out not to be the case. So we boarded another bus for another 2 days to get from Kent, Washington down to Pasadena. So my father was able to enroll at Pasadena City College while receiving some public aid. My mom went to trade school, but our cash eventually ran out. So we could not even pay our part of the rent because we didn't have enough cash. And this is not a lavish apartment that we were living in. We were sharing a 2-bedroom, 1-bath apartment with 3 other men. So there were 5 adults and 1 child in a 2-bedroom, 1-bath apartment. And we could not afford our part of the rent. So my parents looked around the community and found this couple who had a large garage that they boarded up with plywood, and they were willing to rent it out to us for $250 a month. And so we moved out of the apartment, went into that garage, and there we stayed for 2.5 years while my parents, while my father gained his education at Pasadena City College. But we survived. You know, we cooked outdoors for 2.5 years. I did homework under halogen lamps in that garage. We used the bathroom and showers in the main house when we were allowed to, and we survived. I did well in school. We moved into our own condo after my father graduated and got a job in the defense industry as an electronic technician. And then we moved to San Gabriel. I went to high school, did well there, and got accepted to UCLA just 3.5 years after we moved out of the garage.
That is an incredible story. In many ways, it sounds like the immigrant success story, coming from extremely trying circumstances, having no money, of course, trying to find a proper footing in some sort of education or job, and having a son who goes on to become an emergency room doctor in California. Let's talk a little bit about that, Dr. Lay. I think people would say, well, why emergency medicine? That seems like that would be such a stressful choice of practice. You know, dermatology is a lot, seems a lot more safer or less stressful.
Yeah, it's my journey into emergency medicine wasn't a straight line either. After college at UCLA, I took a couple of years to try to get into medical school. And when I couldn't, I actually went to dental school for 2 years. While I was in dental school, I realized that I really didn't like it that much. So I reapplied to medical school and got into medical school. And when I started seeing patients in the on my rotations in my third year, I realized that I really loved everything about medicine. I loved how we use our knowledge of science and the anatomy and chemistry and pharmacology and surgery to help all these patients in different ways. So every rotation that I was rotating through, every specialty, I wanted to be that specialist for the rest of my life. When I realized that I couldn't do that, one of my residents, senior residents, actually said, you know, if you really love all these different specialties as much as you say you do, you may want to try emergency medicine. And I tried it at the first chance that I could, which was the first rotation of my fourth year of medical school. And I went to Grand Blanc in Michigan, at this beautiful hospital called Genesis Hospital. And I absolutely loved it. I loved every minute of it. And I came back and I told my wife, we were dating at the time, I said, I think I found my specialty. This is it. So then I put all my eggs in that basket and it worked out. I ended up doing residency in Chicago at Resurrection Medical Center. which is still a thriving residency program now. I learned a lot taking care of some of the sickest patients in Chicago, and I've never looked back. This was what I was meant to do. Sure, it can be very stressful at times, and there's a lot of cause for burnout, but mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I love what I do. I've become very good at what I do. I think emergency medicine has a real is the real safety net for the community when they need us. Whether or not you have the ability to pay, you can always go to your nearest ER, see an emergency medicine physician, and we'll take good care of you. So I still love what I do. I've been out of residency now for 17 years, and I still look forward to every single shift that I go into.
Wow, that's admirable, Dr. Lay. That's truly admirable, especially given the nature of the work that you do. Let's talk about the work that you're doing outside the hospital, because I find that equally fascinating. You would think that, you know, after a long day at the hospital, all you want to do is go home and, you know, sort of veg out, but not Dr. Lay, of course. You have this whole life outside medicine, which involves philanthropy. And one of the programs you're involved with is this Honor Flight program, which gives vets from the World War II, Korean War, and older Vietnam vets a chance to go back to Washington, D.C. Tell me how you got involved in that, a little bit about the program and why it is so gratifying for you.
Yeah, so in order for me to talk about my work with Honor Flight, I have to bring back to in my father. My father was a graduate of the South Vietnamese Naval Academy. So he was part of the Navy for many years. And as luck would have it, I married a woman whose father was also part of the South Vietnamese Navy. So my father-in-law and my father were armed forces. So when we got on our feet here in San Diego, and we were looking for community groups that we can participate in order to serve others. My wife and I decided to look up Honor Flight San Diego. She came to learn about the program when she served some veterans from Korea and World War II when she worked at the VA in Loma Linda. And we found them, and we found out that the group here in San Diego would charter a plane and then gather volunteers and veterans and take them from San Diego to Washington, D.C. for a tour of honor. The first groups were all World War II veterans, but as the numbers got less and less, we moved on to Korean War and Vietnam War veterans. What's so gratifying about this is that many of them just quietly left their life of service to this country and went back to their regular life. But during the time of conflicts, they and their families sacrificed so much. And now in their final years of life, we're able to give them this trip where everyone that comes in contact with them just want to hold their hands, listen to their stories, and just say thank you. Many of our World War II veterans would pass away within a year of them returning from their flight, and they would say that it is the one of the best trips that they've ever taken in their life. I'm sure that's not actually true, but in their recent memory, it probably is. As their bodies break down, they're not able to travel the way they normally do. And so to fly all the way across the country and see our nation's capital, see all the monuments that are built in their honor, to honor their service, and to have it all just catered to honor their service is has been very, very gratifying to be able to provide that experience for them. I've become friends with many of them. Unfortunately, many of them soon pass away, but the experience of their friend, being there with them through this trip and then having their friendship after the trip is invaluable to my development and my growth and to my kids as well.
What I think also is interesting is many of these veterans had never really been able to talk at length about their wartime experiences. They came back to civilian life. They moved on. And for some reason, maybe the families didn't want to hear about their experiences. Maybe they were reticent about that. So this is actually a time for them to reconnect with their younger selves and kind of relive, not relive, but just remember what they've been through.
Yeah. I think the group that, that really, are getting the most out of this tour of honor are our aged Vietnam War veterans. Yeah. When they came back to America, they sacrificed so much. And yet when they came back to America, they were spit at, they were shunned, people were screaming at them, calling them various names. And so that was such a black mark on our history in terms of how we treat our veterans. And our organization is there to correct at least some of those harms that have been done. The first trip that we had all Vietnam War veterans was a couple of years ago in 22, where we came back with a plane full of a Vietnam War Purple Heart veterans. And I brought out the Vietnam Vietnamese community to the airport, including my parents, to welcome them home. And just the tears and the satisfaction of, yes, you know, what we did make a difference. It did matter. And there are people who appreciate that, that those emotions that came out were just so obvious and so gratifying to be able to provide them that relief and that closure.
Just hearing you talk about it makes me feel a little emotional as well. A lot of the veterans, I believe, some of them, not a lot, but some veterans are also part of the unhoused community right now for different reasons. Is that one of the reasons you also became involved with setting up these pop-up medical clinics for the unsheltered and unhoused? What got you involved with that?
Yeah, I think that many physicians have the capacity to provide free care outside of their regular work if they had the capacity in terms of time. What happened to me was that I went on a medical mission to Africa with my entire family, and it opened my eyes to the fact that out of all the different specialties, I have the specialty of emergency medicine allows for me to be the most effective out there because I know a little bit about everything. And so when I came back from that trip, I was inspired to find a population in my community that I can serve. So I started the pop-up clinics at Father Joe's Villages, providing free medical care once a month. That has since expanded to free haircuts, free clothing, free food, various things, with the support of my organization, which is Vituity Cares Foundation. They provide me with the funding to provide all of this care, but all the actual labor is all voluntary. The fringe benefit of that is that, as you mentioned, a certain portion of the population are veterans. And so we're able to talk to the veterans and make sure that they are aware of their benefits, steer them to the right people who can set them up with the right paperwork so that they can receive those benefits. But it is a challenging population to care for. Sometimes they don't want to talk to you at all. And it's it you almost have to bribe them to be able to care for them. We try to move beyond that so that we can do the right thing for them, which is to provide care for them where they are.
How do you get the funding for this? Is it supported by any, I guess, state or federal grants?
Vituity Cares Foundation receives no funding from the federal government. We are We are supported by the physicians who work at Vituity, which is a partnership of physicians who staff hospitals and clinics across the country. A certain portion of our earnings goes towards funding our efforts. And we also receive donations from private individuals and corporations or hospital systems that believe in what we do. But we receive no funding from the government.
That must be difficult because you're relying on the largesse and generosity of some private donors as well, especially in this time when a lot of funding sources have become constrained. What is, aside from the funding and the fact that you are providing this tremendous essential service to people who don't always have access to proper medical services, you're also giving younger physicians, younger medical providers, a chance to work with a population that they may not always see or frequently interact with?
One of the things that I've found out about myself is that I'm good at mentoring the mm-hmm. younger generation. I can speak to them very easily. And so I've reached out to my younger friends and I've brought them into the fold of serving our unhoused population here. And they tell their friends and then they tell their friends and their family. So I have generations of students coming through as young as high school and as old as just graduating from residency and becoming physicians. I bring them in and I welcome everyone who wants to serve, including their parents, their grandparents, anyone who's willing to come down and help me hand out clothing, hand out food, corral, the masses, just to make sure that we do all that we can to serve our unhoused population for that day.
How many times a month now is it, Dr. Lay?
It's just once a month.
Okay. And it's in more than just San Diego. San Diego, you mentioned Father Joe, which is a well-known nonprofit here in San Diego that serves the homeless, but you have other locations as well now. Is that right?
That is correct. We started out with just four locations in California. I was one of the original clinic here in San Diego, but our organization has grown to 16 clinics and at the end of 2023. And that's just 3 years from the onset of when we established our foundation. And in 2020, by the end of 2024, we hope to have 24 clinics around the country.
That is remarkable, Dr. Lay. Congratulations. You're doing such tremendous work. And lastly, you are a busy man. You are also a board member on the board of directors for the USS Midway Museum. I don't know where you find the time to do all this stuff, in addition to being an ER doctor. The Midway Museum is also a very important institution here in San Diego. It has special significance for you, though, as a refugee from Vietnam. Tell me a little bit about that.
In 2015 was the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. Mm. And the Midway hosted a very large remembrance of that dark day for my parents' country. And so we went down there and we learned about the Midway and everything that it did during the war and everything that it stands for now. And from that day forward, I was looking for a way to gain entrance to the volunteer force that's on the Midway now. In 2019, during an honor flight trip, I coincidentally ran into the director of human resources, Jill Hammonds. And I told her, I said, I absolutely love the museum and I love everything that the ship did during the Vietnam War and what it's doing now for the community. How can I get involved? Mm-hmm. And she looked around and she found me a spot on a committee, the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, sure. which I immediately accepted. After 2 years of service on that committee, the CEO at that time, Mac McLaughlin, asked me to be on the board. And that's when I joined the board at the beginning of 2022. 2023. And I've been on the board since then. So it's been very gratifying to be a part of the history and the service of what the Midway is doing for the community, bringing children on board and educating them in technology and about our men and women who serve this country. And moving forward, we're going to be building Freedom Park, a large park around the Midway that is going to continue to serve the community for decades to come.
That is very, very impressive. Very impressive, Dr. Lay. Where do you get this boundless energy?
I try to keep myself healthy and active and involved. It for as much energy that I put into my activities, it really drives me to be a better person and bring out the best in me. So these activities really feed me as well as me, you know, serving the community.
Looking at your life story, one might conclude that Dr. Lay, your life and your accomplishments are kind of a personification of the immigrant success story. Here now in 2024, as we move into a presidential election, we hear so much about what to do about our country's immigration policies. I don't want to put you on the spot. I know you're not a politician, but you do have experience in this area, being part of a wave of refugees who came to this country seeking freedom and more opportunities. What do you make of this debate about how we are able to welcome immigrants? Lately, there's been a lot of rhetoric that kind of sort of villainizes or vilifies folks who are coming to these shores, to the borders. Sometimes they're characterized as not very productive people who are going to be a poison on American society. I know it angers me when I hear that kind of extreme talk. What do you think, Dr. Lay? What is your perspective on this?
So I am completely apolitical when it comes to big societal problems. I think that politicians exploit situations for their own gain. The truth of the matter is that a country with a low birth rate will hurt itself without immigration. So case in point is a country like Japan had such restrictive immigration policies that now that their birth rate is less than one, their economy is beginning to suffer and has been suffering for the last decade. We're going to see that with South Korea as well. So why has the U.S. economy been so resilient? There's only one explanation. It is the influx of continued labor force through immigration. Now, do we need to fix the immigration system? Yes. We cannot have chaos at our borders. It is just not sustainable. But to say that we need to close off immigration is to be blinded to the fact that immigration is the only way that our economy has stayed resilient and is still growing at a pace that no one could have predicted. So I think that with many of our society's problems, we need to get beyond the politics and get down to problem solving and getting things done that will drive our country forward and upward.
Well, it seems to be your point that immigrants to this country, new Americans, actually enhance the lifeblood of our society in so many ways, culturally and economically. And you're an
Absolutely.
Example of that. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I wanted to ask you, you know, it's been an observation, at least of mine, that we are very much self-centered as a society. You know, we have all our social media and we want to put ourselves on there and do this and that and the other. And your life is very other-centered, other-oriented. How do we encourage other people towards acts of service or a life of service?
I can only tell that that truth from my own experience. I can't guarantee that others will have the same rewards as I do, but I'm going to continue to tell that story in the hopes that if, you know, that one person that I tell it to will then initiate in their own lives to go out there and to serve others, then that would have been worth it. So I can't convince people otherwise. I would just continue to keep telling that story in the hopes that it will drive people to do the right thing by serving others.
It's certainly a powerful story, and I love to hear you tell it. I've enjoyed this conversation so much. And I want to thank you for joining us today. If listeners want to hear more about your story or actually get involved with your foundation, Vituity, what are the websites or places they should check out?
Thank you. If you want to learn more about Vituity Cares Foundation, you can go to vitutycares.org. If you want to get involved with the Midway, you can go to our USS Midway Museum website. We're on multiple social media outlets as well. And if you want to learn about Honor Flight San Diego, you can go to honorflight.org. And then if you want to reach out to me personally, you can find me on LinkedIn, Fale, D-O, on LinkedIn.
Okay, great. Well, I mean, you're one of these guests who has a lot of stuff going on. And so, you know, just listing your websites and your social media, it's really impressive. Thank you so much, Dr. Fale, for being our guest today. We also want to hear from you, our valued listeners, about any suggestions for future guests or topics on Asian Pacific Voices Radio. Also, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and our YouTube channel, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Asian Pacific Voices Radio is produced by Asian Culture and Media Alliance. That's a nonprofit that empowers our Asian and Pacific Islander communities with a voice to the media arts. If you would like to support our program, please visit AsianPacificVoicesRadio.com. I'm Sasha Fu. Thanks so much for listening. And please join us next week for another exciting and thought-provoking Asian Pacific Voices Radio show. Until then, take care.